Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You know, the last time I played this song, and Grant was on, I used it as a bumper. It's called a bumper in the radio business. Toby Keith singing, right? So, off the cuff, I mentioned to Grant that I could sing the shit out of this song. And since Japan, I believe, is the founding entity of karaoke, if I'm saying that correctly, I would pronounce it karaoke. But I think Grant educated me last time. And Grant dropped the little nugget that he's, in fact, an incredible karaoke singer. So joining the program once again is one of the great karaoke singers in the Pacific Rim, Grant Newsham. Grant, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And you're correct. If it was a room full of Japanese people, they would all think I was the best karaoke speaker there for English language songs.
The things you find out about people, right? The things you find out about people. And when I kind of tried to pin you down for a song, like my go-to, that would be my go-to right there. You were kind of, whatever. I don't really have a go-to song. So has that changed in the last few months as you've been, a night owl in karaoke bars across the Pacific Rim? Have you gravitated towards one? Maybe Queen, Freddie Mercury? Has that changed at all?
Oh, well, I don't. Yeah, I seem to speak to human beings about once every 3 days, so I haven't been hanging out in these places.
Damn it.
I think I might have mentioned that if I was like, somebody held like a gun or a samurai sword to my head and said, okay, Newsham, sing, I think Frank Sinatra's Fly Me to the Moon would come on. immediately to mind.
Would
I would be pretty sure of surviving, actually. Yeah.
So anybody needs a funeral singer or a wedding singer whose specialty is Fly Me to the Moon, right? You can, all you got to do is do a search for Grant. You get his contact information, or you can email me and I'd be happy to hook you guys up.
I think you will. But as I may have mentioned, I have a range. It's not like I'm anything, but it's like oily lounge singer. Like I'd be like, you go to like Vegas and up on like the third floor of MGM, not on the first floor, way up on the third floor in one of these distant lounges. There's some guy who like used to be an ex, defensive tackle at Utah State, who's singing the kind of songs I do. And that's about as far as he gets into the show business. So that's where I would slot into the music pantheon.
Well, I think that if you listen to most singers, what they've done is they've crafted a career out of a range. It's not like they all can span, like Wide World Sports did, spanning the globe of sports when they presented, Wide World of Sports on Saturday to us, right? Most singers have a definite range, and they stay in that range, and then they make a pretty decent career. I'm a Springsteen fan. A lot of people have told me, he's not really a singer, right? I said, what do you mean? I'm like, well, listen to him. He's very limited in terms of what he can do, but he's obviously been commercially successful, but I don't really consider him a singer. I was like, are you kidding? Okay, take your blasphemy and get out of here. But when you do listen to singers, and Sinatra was no different, right? He had, and here's a little Summer Wind by Frank Sinatra. All right, so you can imagine Frank Sinatra rolling out in Manhattan for the midnight show, right? He got his tux on. By the midnight show, the bow tie's undone. He's got a cigarette in his hand. He's got some scotch in his hand and the microphone in the other hand. That's how this guy made a living, and here he is.
Yeah.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea. Lingered there to touch your head and walk with me
Come on, man. How do you know?
Boy, this is like there's a room full of like Yakuza and Japanese businessmen ready to listen to me. Get out, man.
Okay. I want to start our conversation. Reuters just did one of their special reports, and Reuters is no bullshit news, okay, just for everybody. They're one of the few legitimate news sources on the planet, okay? The Associated Press, I would say the Wall Street Journal, everything outside of that, other than Grant's writings, I would tell you to cast a jaundiced eye at. Anyway, headline, Reuters special report. China expands its amphibious forces in a challenge to U.S. supremacy beyond Asia. Grant, why does that make me laugh?
Because you're like 90% of the people in the Marine Corps. I don't know. It's
well, hold on. Let me. I'll give you the background. Right? Is the United States Navy interested in amphibious operations?
Few of them.
No, the answer to that is no, they're not. It's like some people are relegated to the ash heap of amphibious warfare, and you know, the real serious aviators, you know, naval people go aviation, they go aircraft carriers, right? They go subs. Okay, that's where the Navy wants to be. Amphibious operation, right? Why? If we just didn't have videotape or film of World War II, we could be done with this shit, okay? But we do. Interesting, the Chinese have come to a very different conclusion about amphibious operation. It is one of the final pieces, right, power projection to supplanting the United States around the world. So, thoughts on that?
Did you read the article? No, I'm joking, but I'm quoted in there.
I started reading it and then I had to come on the air, and you're quoted in it. So you were. So what do you say in it?
Like 99% of the Marine office. No, I'm joking about that. But I forget exactly what I said. But I said the Chinese are going to do it. You know, they see it as important. They've got a lot of stuff lined up. I think that's my closing line, and they consider amphibious operations to be, as you've put it, a necessary tool in the toolbox for asserting their power, their presence around the globe. And
okay, hold on. Let me read you exactly what you said. All right,
unless you
provide us some disinformation, and that way we can hold you accountable. Quote. Without an amphibious force, any military force is greatly constrained in where and how it can conduct operations, said Grant Newsham, a retired Marine Corps colonel and researcher at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. Newsham advised the Japanese military on the formation of Tokyo's own amphibious rapid deployment brigade, formed in 2018. Quote, jets can drop bombs and ships can fire missiles at the shore. But you might need infantry to go ashore and kill the enemy and occupy the ground. Yeah, hold on. Now those are two of the three places where Newsham is cited. Newsham, a retired Marine colonel, said the PLA had assembled a formidable army amphibious force and sufficient ships, military and civilian, to probably land enough troops on Taiwan as part of a full-scale attack that includes air, missile, naval, and cyber assaults. The PLA already has a lot lined up, he said. And let me just tell you where that appears in the story, which is important, okay? It's the final paragraph, quotes our guest, Grant Newsham.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. How about that for a little serendipity this morning?
It is. With all of these things, you know, I like to give the guy a few hundred words so he can use about 20, which is pretty good. But the point of I thought the article was well done, and it doesn't overstate things, nor does it understate things, but it really gave a good sense of how the Chinese view that amphibious capability and what they intend to do with it, and how eventually they'll get around to it. But in the immediate term, they have the ability to really seize any small land, sort of piece of land in the South China Sea or in the Asia region. Getting Taiwan's a much bigger thing, but they do not see that as out of the realm of possibility even now. They would prefer to have Taiwan just roll over and let them come in because it's easier, but they are dead serious about being able to conduct an amphibious operation on Taiwan, against Taiwan proper. And they see that as missing, as a unfinished business from 1950, when they got just about everything except Taiwan or Formosa.
We might add, as a separate footnote, there is no historical claim, I mean, in fact, that the Chinese have over Formosa. So, I mean, it's, you know, one of the things Grant has done is educate us all on some of the, I wouldn't even call them nuances, some of the low-hanging, ripe, gigantic, you know, premises in these arguments are so flawed, it's a joke. And so my education in this realm comes from none other than our current guest, the authority for Reuters, much of Reuters' article, Grant Newsham. Wow, your stock's going up from somebody who was shunned, right? Your stock's going up. You're like, are you asking for a raise from somebody, I hope?
No, it just means when you hit my name in Google, it comes up more often. But they also quote a fellow named Ian Easton, who's excellent. He's very good. But when I made that earlier snide comment about 90% of the Marine Corps laughing at the idea of Chinese with an amphibious capability, that is, I wouldn't say it's been, yeah, that's pretty much been my experience, though I haven't canvassed 90% of the Marine Corps or the officer corps, but often you would have people respond to the notion that the Chinese could possibly do any sort of large-ish, competent amphibious operation with a snort. You know, so it's the most complex, difficult military operation there is. And then implicitly, and everyone knows the Chinese will never be as good as us. You discover at the Chosin Reservoirs that they could surprise you. But I would come across that, and it was a dismissiveness which I thought was dangerous. And you'll even notice in the most recent Department of Defense, it's like a sort of a China power report, that they use almost that language once again, is they say, well, we think it is outside of China's capabilities at the present time to assault Taiwan. And the reason being because it's complicated, it's complex. Well, yeah, but if you look at what the Chinese have done to build up their amphibious force over the last 30, 40 years, that you really have to be impressed with how they've gone about it and what they've got in mind. And it's the latest development is the rapid expansion of the Marine Corps itself, the Chinese Marine Corps, because they had always had that role in the Army. And the Army's had, you know, 40, 50,000 specifically amphibious trained troops. And that was before they sort of beefing up the Marine Corps, which until just a few years ago was only 10, 12,000 Marines. So when you actually look at what they do, and if you look at what they've done in the past, you've got to, you know, you really ought to take stock of that and take them more seriously. So I wish the U.S. Navy would, but that your comment is correct. You know, Tom Cruise in Top Gun was not an amphibious ship skipper. He was an F-14 pilot. But the amphib guys were
and
great.
Oh, by the way, he swapped out his Japan and Taiwan patches for something less controversial, just for the record, in the second movie, at the behest of Chinwa.
Oh, yeah. You've got to bang your forehead on the ground in front of the emperor. There's nothing Americans won't do for money. Some Americans. And that's what they did. It's, I think, disgusting, but yeah, but the evidence is there.
The United States, it just, again, a series of ironies, right? As China expands to make its amphibious arm more capable, we're in the process of dismantling ours or morphing ours for a specific region, but essentially taking the Navy off the hook for that which we have, you know, held them on, you know, for decades. And so an interesting dichotomy in terms of becoming world power or sustaining world power and how each nation perceives it. If you look at the glide paths of the two countries, right, who will be who will be the premier amphibious nation on the planet in 10 years?
Well, how could it possibly be anyone but us? You know, we have the sort of brimming hubris or self-esteem, but if we're not careful, you know, we're going to find ourselves way behind. And, you know, one very good, the evidence is out there. And one thing that's worth a look is what the Chinese have done in Djibouti, where they have made a military base, and they've got, I don't know, 600 Marines or so with armor. And it's really the foot in the door. And you're going to see that expand gradually. They do it at their own time. And it's slower, and it doesn't seem quite as systematic or organized as we do. But Djibouti's ought to be a wake-up call. In fact, it was a wake-up call. And when people tried to issue the warning, that they were all poo-pooed by the State Department, even DOD.
Loathes that group too. The intelligentsia of the State Department and the DOD that pat people on the head. They are not your favorite group of people, eh?
Oh, I don't mind. You know, I don't loathe people. My mother told me we don't hate people years ago. But you wish they would. They have the opportunity to excel. I think if they should ever, they could perhaps do a bit better sometime.
Listen to you. You're spinning like a champion this morning.
You don't want to write everyone off. But they did. And when it comes to Djibouti, they were warned and of what was coming. And that was like in 2007-08. And they just dismissed it as, well, China has no interest in this region. They're not, you don't have a military angle to it, etc. And you Marines, shut up. You're out of your lane. That was the response. I mean, this was so obvious that, like, even a guy from Baltimore could have figured it out. You know, I'm not being mean. It's
you kind of were. Right? Baltimore is your whipping.
If you knew the backstory, you'd know I'm not. But they were warned, and this was, once again, they were dismissing what the Chinese are capable of. And once again, well, you don't overstate it. At the same time, we have underestimated them routinely. And you look at their naval buildup, et cetera, the improvements they have made in their military, and then jump into the economic realm. You know, I used to work for Motorola, and Motorola was convinced the Chinese could never be their equals. Well, the Chinese now own what is left of Motorola. So that's my take on that. But the amphibious thing's very, it's an interesting thing to watch. And, you know, I thought the article was good in, I think, stating the issues sort of in a even keel sort of way.
All right. We will, it's for those of you listening, the article is included in this post. All right. So, as you clicked on it, if you scroll down it, you'll see the link to this Reuters article, which Grant Newsham is one of the experts that's talked about. The United States formally said, we don't recognize China's claims in the South China Sea. That's my phraseology, Grant. Is that what we did last week, or can you explain that a little bit?
Well, that is what we did. The in going back just a little bit, in 2016, something called the Permanent Court of Arbitration. It's an international court issued a ruling in response to a case which the Philippines brought against China. And the Philippines claimed that China had taken their territory, their maritime territory, in the South China Sea. And the court ruled, finally in 2016, in favor of the Philippines. And usually these kind of decisions kind of split the difference and split the baby and give everybody a little bit of something. But this was like 99% in the Philippines' favor. And that rarely happens. So the court said China is completely wrong. They have unlawfully seized, laid claim to the South China Sea base. That's a simple way to put it. And the Chinese response was to say this was just the ruling is a piece of waste paper. We're not going to follow it. And the response of the Obama administration was to not really say anything and leave the Philippines holding this court ruling, but without the Americans speaking up on their behalf. And finally, now 4 years later, a U.S. administration has said the court ruling was correct and we agree with it. And what China is doing in the South China Sea is against the law. And we are going to act on that basis from now on. And so it was almost epical or momentous to have an administration actually say that. One sort of a way analogy, one way to kind of conceptualize it is that if, say, you're in a playground and there's this big bully who's, pushing people around, is taking their lunch money, telling them they can't sit there, they can't use the swings, etc., because it belongs to them.
You can use them, you just have to pay me to use the swing.
Well, that's the idea. It's my mind. If you want to use it, you're going to have to pay me or whatever. And finally, there's this other big guy in the playground who doesn't say much, but he's about going about his business. He's kind of averting his eyes even. And then finally, one day, he wakes up and says, "Enough." And everyone hears him, and that's where we're at now. We've said enough. And the question is, now everyone's wondering, both the bully and all of the terrorized kids, okay, what's he going to do?
Yeah, what now?
And that's where we're at. But this was the first time any U.S. administration has actually spoken up this clearly and this directly on this issue. And the wording of the statement, it goes down the list and it actually cites the specific pieces of territory that belong to the Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam, Malaysia, and it refers to them by name and says that what the Chinese are doing with them, the Chinese claim to these, are illegal. And they're kind of talking to the regional nations to show that America is no longer just keeping its eyes primly averted, but America has effectively taken sides. And it also refers to the natural resources, the fish, the oil, et cetera, in the South China Sea and China's intention to claim ownership and China's claiming ownership over all of these and interfering with other nations trying to develop the resources in their own maritime exclusive economic zones. America, the statement specifically referred to those, and so is more specifically calling out the Chinese and saying, enough. But now we're going to see what happens next.
All right. Next item on the agenda is Huawei and the UK, a bit stunning, in my opinion. I saw that and I went, whoa. Not often that you see the United States throw a hissy fit and somebody do an about face on something that they seem to be relatively far down the road on. Yet that is, in fact, what appears to have happened with the UK. Give me your thoughts on it and your thoughts specifically on the significance of this, because that is reverberating around the world a little bit.
Oh, it's a big deal. Because so much, if you look at what the, you know, sort of the talk about America's efforts to apply economic pressure and on China, and with Huawei in particular, one of the complaints has been, well, it's just America. Nobody else is going along with it. In fact, the press, the U.S. is Vestia and Pravda press. They were crowing not long ago at the so-called failure of America's efforts to rein in Huawei. They're just gloating in the apparent failure of Mr. Trump's efforts. And now you have the British, along with what the Australians have already done, and the Canadians are on the, just might come along too. But the British have said, as you noted, they've reversed course and said, we're not going to use Huawei. And UK companies, you have until, I think it's 2025, 2027 to strip it out of your systems, but there's not going to be any new stuff. And the one thing that really does scare the Chinese is being presented with a united front against them. When you have not just the Americans, but you have a network of countries that take them on, that causes them a lot of problems. And if you get more countries to join in the Huawei effort, anti-Huawei effort, plus other, just other efforts to stand up against Chinese aggressiveness, that Beijing has got to be worried. But when the Prime Minister Johnson of England, he changed his mind, and it was partly because I think some people of influence in his conservative party were up in arms, but also he got the Chinese virus earlier this year and was not well for a while. There was some talk that he may not survive. And I think he has a wife who's a real, like she's the kind who could wield a rolling pin, I'm told, with, and use it pretty well. And apparently she got it too. So I imagine neither of them is all that well disposed towards China on those grounds. And that may have shaped his thinking to a degree. But it's interesting. You don't always see an administration anywhere just suddenly shift course 180 degrees.
No, I saw that, I mean, I'll use the word stunning, because it was that in a relative context, because – you know, the president and the administration, it was several months ago, said, that they, what do they call it? The Five Eyes? What is that group that we share intelligence with? That the UK, if they went down this road, would put that historic and enduring relationship at risk. And you read that and you went, wow, we're getting pretty serious here. And so then I fully expected, the UK to say, well, we respect, our historical relationship with the United States, blah, 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 blah. And so, I mean, to me, that news was stunning. And I want to ask you a question, because to me, what you said, the most dangerous course of action for the free world against China is to act in concert. And yet we rarely see it. And so, Is part of Chinese diplomacy, and dare I say, Chinese expats that are still considered Chinese citizens by the government of China, some of their efforts around the world are consistently designed to undermine that course of action, both in the media, maybe at institutions of higher learning, to present China as this, as this Winnie the Pooh figure, and certainly not a danger to anybody as China attempts to eat the entire planet. Your thoughts on that?
Well, that's very much what they do, is that you try to split the opposition into smaller bites and ideally turn them against each other. And that's their MO everywhere. Back to the South China Sea, the Chinese they've tried to deal with the ASEAN states individually, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, sort of the regional nations and the ones that have specific claims on the South China Sea or that could present a unified front against the Chinese, what the Chinese are doing. The Chinese have been very careful to try and get them each individually. Because as the Chinese have said, well, we're a big country and you're little countries. Take that.
Right.
And they don't want ASEAN to present a unified front against them. And in the UK, they've done something similar, really using money. We're able to buy off huge parts of the British industry. Britain's financial sector actually kind of makes ours look principled, is how bad it is. You know, it's welcoming the Russians. Oh, please come. Any corrupt, anybody who's got money has been welcome in the so-called City of London, which is what you call their Wall Street. But within Britain's elite classes, the Chinese influence peddling and was extremely effective. And that's what makes Boris Johnson's sort of shift so surprising, because the Chinese really got their claws into the country. And with particularly during conservative administrations, David Cameron, previous former prime minister not long ago, when he was in office, he did his best to sell out the country to Chinese money. And like the day after he left, he started a billion-dollar hedge fund to invest in China with Chinese partners. It just doesn't get any worse than this. There's even an excellent book which has just come out called Hidden Hand by a fellow named Clive Hamilton. He's an Australian, and it is a prosecutor's brief on what the Chinese have done in the United Kingdom. And it's coincidental. It just came out, I think. But it's that's how they did it. Like you said, they try to split the opposition. And you look at how they've even done in the U.S. and have had considerable success of it until this administration came along. And even now that it's here, you still got sort of a chunk of our ruling class or our elite class, which is just dying for a chance to get things back to the way they were with China, mostly because it was really profitable.
Right. I mean, come on. I mean, like, what are we doing here, folks? I mean, are we going to, like, worry about, you know, things like human rights and Chinese overthrow of a rules-based order that we've had since post-World War II? I mean, come on, let's get serious. Like, let's all make some money and whatever happens, happens. I mean, come on.
Yeah, you've got to have a nuanced approach. Everybody knows that. You just don't get it, Mac.
Nuanced is code for soulless. You can't have a soul in the context that Grant uses that. The book is called Hidden Hand, Exposing How the Chinese Communist Party is Reshaping the World. And let's see, it was released, and it says September 8th, 2020, which I guess is when it will be out. Is that how that works, or is it out now, Grant? Have you seen it?
I think it's outish now. It's already out, I think, in Australia. But one of the British, these basically Quislings groups, they actually sued to prevent its release.
Of course.
In Canada, I think, because that's the next place it's coming. And they actually sued. I don't know how that's been resolved, but the author knows his stuff and said, you know, we stand by what we wrote and our lawyers will take care of it. And I think this is coming. But the author is Clive Hamilton is really good. You know, he isn't what you would consider a right winger. He's the other side's worst nightmare because he's from he's what you would call a liberal guy in the current meaning. But he's interested in truth and facts and subversion. And he has really opened the lid on it. But he's, you got to admire his courage because he has been under some threat from Chinese interests.
There's a story out as of a few minutes ago, written in the Wall Street Journal. U.S. accuses two of stealing secrets from U.S. firms for China. Alleged hackers tested defenses at four American firms working on coronavirus treatment, testing vaccine research in recent months. How important is it to China to make sure that they either produce or steal the vaccine for COVID-19, the vaccination that's currently being developed around the world, different competing versions of it? How important is it for them to lead in this area?
Very important to them. The virus vaccine is just the latest. You know, they've been so aggressive in just talking about industrial commercial theft and then technology theft for both commercial and military purposes. It's a full court press that's been going on for 30 years now. You know, if you consider a basketball game where a team will sometimes, you know, they'll press for a few minutes, you know, put on this kind of extreme defense. But yes, the Chinese, this is the equivalent of doing it every minute of every game for 20 seasons. That's how aggressive they have been at this. And this has been, is no secret. It's been well known for, 25 years ago, the few parts of the U.S. government were actually talking about it. And yet it's taken this long for somebody to finally get around to doing something about it. And once again, there's no reason any administration couldn't have done this, but they all chose not to. And it's this one. You'll notice the FBI's director, Wray, gave a speech just the other day, as did Attorney General Barr and Pompeo and O'Brien as well. But Wray and Barr in specifically were talking about Chinese theft. And it's as big an epidemic. I'd say it's a bigger epidemic than the Chinese virus that they've inflicted on us.
What was the percentage that Ray said of the counterespionage cases that the FBI has opened that apply to China? It was like what, 3/4 or some ridiculous number?
It was something like that. And he figured like they open a new case every 12 hours or 10 hours or something. But, you know, I used to work for Motorola and I saw the and so knew something of the topic. But the scale and just the breadth of this, it was just all encompassing. And if you do business with a Chinese entity, you should expect to lose everything you have. And unfortunately, it tends to tar kind of anybody from China who works for you. And then there's plenty, though, of Westerners who've been glad to get in on it as well. But the Chinese government sees its citizens, its nationals overseas as a resource to be used. And a lot of them, unfortunately, do take it up as a, you know, way to make some money. And or to, you know, further the great, you know, Han Chinese nation. But there's just it's almost the way a dog licks itself. You know, it kind of can't help it because it's what they do. And unfortunately, that's what, you know, the People's Republic of China has become when it comes to stealing other people's ideas, technology, etc., and then making use of it. But it is as bad a problem as has been described. And once again, it really is noteworthy that you had the FBI director and the attorney general in particular talk about this in a sort of set speeches that were very carefully drafted. But this is, you know, it's 20 years. This could have happened 20 years ago. Now, some would say better. It is better late than never. But boy, we spotted the other side a lot of runs. That was interesting to see. And, you know, I mentioned there were four speeches given by those figures, Ray, Barr, O'Brien, the National Security Council director, and Secretary Mike Pompeo. all of them dealing with China, different aspects of it, Barr in particular calling out Chinese American companies for effectively doing the Chinese communist bidding and seeming to have no sense of patriotism or even right and wrong. You know, the willingness to do business with a regime that has concentration camps is committing genocide against its Muslims the way, and even the Washington Post admitted that, for goodness sakes.
Oh my God. I mean, you know, and I will tell you this. I mean, what's interesting is, these two hackers, right? It sounds like living here in the United States, their names, Lee, L-I, Jai, which is X-I-A-O-Y-U, J-U, and Dong, J-Z, both Chinese, whether they be expats or, but Grant has explained to us, how this works in Australia, right? You're Chinese living in Australia. You're not Australian. You're Chinese. And when the motherland calls on you to help, then you will help. And how does China influence, you know, the domestic policies of other countries? And, I mean, you're seeing how it's operationalizing those things that, you know, Grant has explained to us on this program for a couple of years now. So, no.
You know, one point I should, I think it's worth remembering about the overseas Chinese populations is that most of these people left China to get the hell away from the Chinese Communist Party. But the communists have got their enforcers in their sort of their quislings, the people who what's the word, the troop, they've got their own people in these communities, and they basically have a reign of terror going against Chinese who want nothing to do with the PRC. And anyone who speaks out against this is suddenly threatened. Their families back in China are threatened and punished. And this is going on in Chinatowns or Chinese communities all over the world. And this has been a huge failing of successive U.S. administrations, but also in other free countries, but to not crack down on these people who are, you know, intimidating, you know, Chinese who just want to be free. And that's has been a real failing. And you really see it on college campuses, too, with seems like college administrations aiding and abetting the Chinese communists in shutting up anyone who criticizes China. You must have these full tuition paying Chinese students aplenty. But that, say that's it's part of the thing, because part of the equation, because I just wanted to make sure that that is understood, because it isn't as if everybody is willingly helping out the Chinese communists, and most people overseas don't want nothing to do with them. So just threw that in.
Got it. We appreciate the footnote. The you've written a piece. And I know you don't write the title, so here's the title. Taiwan's Tightwad Defense Spending, an Expensive Risk. Subheadline, Taipei needs to spend more on its armed forces and treat them with more respect if it hopes to repel a Chinese invasion. What's the genesis of that article? Why?
I've noticed it for a long time. And well, the use of the word tightwad, I'd probably have to be like 15, 20 years older than I am to use it. It's probably like something out of the musical Hello Dolly.
I know. Hey, Larry, the guy's a tightwad, right? Like, things you don't see used in headlines often, although, you know, entirely appropriate. And then, you know, it makes you, I mean, I smiled when I read it. And but it did catch my eye, the word tightwad. I like it.
It worked for me too. You and I, we live in that sort of no man's land between like being like our parents and being hip, you know, young guys. But so why I wrote it is because I've dealt with the Taiwan military for a number of years, and Taiwan Marines in particular. And if you hang around these guys, you realize that they don't they don't have enough money to like live halfway decently. They don't have enough money to train, to have the proper equipment, etc. And it's just killing them. And nobody seems to quite understand that if you pay for something, it shows you value it. And also it kind of makes your military better. And so what I'm doing is I am pointing out the absolute obvious that like a moderately alert imbecile would understand is that the Taiwan military doesn't have enough money. But what I've always suggested and goes with the Japanese too, is that you've got to spend it on the people, on personnel, so that people want to join the military. So it's a decent, attractive profession. And that's what nobody seems to figure out. Instead, it's, well, we spend money on missiles and anti-tank rockets and M1A1 tanks and F-16 Vipers. But yeah, but your troops live in un-air-conditioned housing. When, it is hot as hell in Taiwan, it's dilapidated, un-air-conditioned. Your family allowances, it's like you get $35 a year for one child. It's crazy how, poor their terms of service are. And that's what I'm getting at here. And it's not surprising they can't attract enough recruits, enough people to join their new all-volunteer force. And yet people act like this is a complicated thing to figure out. And, we think you and I, we can recall the 1970s before Ronald Reagan took over, just how demoralized and kind of dangerous the U.S. military was when it didn't have enough money, when there wasn't enough emphasis paid on the troops and the officers and their families. And that's what I'm pointing out. But it really is just stating the obvious. And Taiwan's government, of course, it just doesn't see it as a priority for whatever reason. But if they don't wake up, they'll be lucky to stay independent or to stay free of the mainland if they don't get on this fast. And the thing is that same with the Japanese. But I wrote it, partly the immediate genesis, and I've written some similar things over the years, but there was a training exercise a few weeks ago, and using this rubber boats, one of the boats tipped over and two Marines were killed. And the president went and said she was really sorry at these people, that this happened, et cetera, et cetera. The Minister of Defense referred to them as national heroes. And my point is, well, you ought to show them some respect while they're still alive. And if you're not going to spend money on it and make their sort of lives better, make them better able to do their jobs and defend the country, show some appreciation for that. You shouldn't even bother to say that you're sorry, because I don't think they're serious. You couldn't quite say that in that many words in the piece, but that's how just tiresome all this gets. And some of the comments I've gotten from this is, from the military's is all been good, and many, many Taiwanese people. But there's also, you'll also hear, well, we spend half of it on personnel as it is, half of our budget. Well, as if spending money on people is a problem. And if you don't get the people right, it doesn't matter what you buy, is my position. I think that's fairly obvious. But that's been some of the feedback. And I think there's a big slice of Taiwanese government, and even in the sort of the educated classes, that just cannot understand why you would want to have like happy, motivated people in your military. It is maddening, because it is not complicated. And that's what I was writing about.
Under the guise of, it's nice when you tell me you love me, but it's better when you show me you love me. Those footnotes are important. We've been having an aircraft carrier festival in the South China Sea. The United States says, I don't know if it's trying to prove to everybody that, hey, right, we're still here. But two aircraft carriers for the last, month or so have been operating in tandem. in the Philippine Sea, in the vicinity of the South China Sea. The Chinese have been doing, we're doing an exercise as well. What's going on? What's your take on that?
Oh, it's the, it's the Americans standing up for themselves. You know, it's funny how this seems so bracing. It's that we're even talking about it, but this should be a regular occurrence, but it's not, or it hasn't been until recently. But yeah, they've got these two carriers and attendant hangers on operating down in the South China Sea. And I think one of them's moved into the Indian Ocean, I think, and is done doing some stuff with the Indians now. I'd look at it as it's not challenging China. It is simply America standing up and exercising its lawful lawful rights and demonstrating that it is not going to be pushed around.
It is confrontational if you see the South China Sea, right? But if you
that's right, yeah.
If you believe
how you look at it, you know, if you're right. If you know there's that bully in the playground, if you say enough and then you start, using his stuff, you know, making clear that you're going to use anything in the playground that you want, and everyone else is too. The bully is going to say, well, why are you threatening? Why are you attacking me? But I think anyone who steps back for a bit and looks at it is the Chinese characterization and the Quisling class characterization of this as us threatening China is seeing it through the wrong prism. But you can, it's predictable that they will do that. But you hear that a lot, particularly from the Western commentariat, is that, well, why are you threatening China? You're scaring them. And they said the same thing about Joseph Stalin's Russia right after World War II, is that, well, the Russians act a certain way because they feel threatened. If you roll over and and make sure you do nothing they might conceive as threatening, they will act nice. It didn't work then, and it doesn't work with the Chinese as well. But you're hearing the same arguments. But if you're either going to stand up and defend yourself, or you're going to lose. You're either going to get the hell beaten out of you in the playground, or if you're just lucky, you're going to be driven out. And you know, sending two carriers down there and operating. I do wonder if it was to also to let the Chinese know that if they have any intention of doing something to Taiwan, particularly trying to grab one of Taiwan's small offshore islands, which they could do from a standing start without us noticing, apparently, that you're going to have to deal with America. I have a feeling that may be part of the thinking behind sending us our carriers down into the South China Sea, just to make sure that there's no problems, particularly given the Chinese virus difficulties and the other problems we're having in the U.S. at the moment.
All right. Before I let you go, baseball season has kicked off. Great elation at being able to watch preseason games, albeit in empty stadiums, but the world champion Washington Nationals take on the perennial champion New York Yankees. Would you care to make a wager so that at some point when our paths do cross, one of us, we can sort out who's going to buy dinner? Scherzer versus Gerrit Cole in Washington.
Who's this Cole guy? Is he like a loser?
Don't worry about it. All right.
Okay.
Don't worry about it. If you have to ask, don't worry about it. So
I've heard the name, but what's the issue here? It's obvious what's coming. It's I'd put your 401k on the Senators or the Nationals.
Either one works. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, you've always been somewhat of a Washington baseball skeptic. Last year, you were proven grossly inaccurate, much to your joy, and so mercifully, organized sports is beginning to get moving again. And I can't tell you what a relief. I mean, just personally, as somebody who likes sports, to have something other than the news, you know, which is horrible these days. And then the news with social media layered on top of it. Is there any way that we can undo that? That scourge upon the planet? It's awful. And having to endure this since, what, March, April, May, June. 5 months of this stuff on a nightly basis. Mercifully, exhibition baseball has returned. But I believe Thursday or Friday, you and I will be betting dinner on the Washington Nationals versus the New York Yankees game. Two of the best pitchers in baseball go at it, and so it'll be nice. And do you want to make any predictions for the year? I mean, have you cast off your jaundiced view of Washington baseball now that you've been proven wrong? Do you want to make any predictions for your Senators/Nationals?
Huh. Well, no.
Hold on. I've got an email for you. Mac, you've got to ask Grant about the Redskin name change.
It's a good question. The mob is, you know, they've been howling outside the gate for a long time. So, at some point you kind of knew they would howl loud enough, I like history. And one sort of, I noticed that the Navajo Nation was elated that the Redskins have given up the name or going to. And, you know, I like history. And I think one of the suggested names was the Code Talkers or such like. And
oh, really?
I call them that. And I admire the Navajo Code Talkers.
Oh, well, I mean, come on. The Navajo, you know, I'll tell you what, when I lived in North Dakota, the University of North Dakota was named the Fighting Sioux. Hmm. Now, not too much derogatory at face value in that. And many people in the Sioux Nation loved it because the University of North Dakota has a hockey team that beats the shit out of everybody. I want to say they're, you know, 7 or 8-time Division I NCAA men hockey champions. But there was a vocal minority on the reservations, and this thing got bigger and bigger, and the more social media that blew it up on a regular basis. And I had a conversation with one guy, and he said it kind of interesting, paralleled what you said. He said, you know, a lot of people that are doing this shit aren't even Sioux. They're not Lakota. They're not Dakota Sioux. They're not Sioux. They're Chippewas. And if you ask them, if we named the university the Fighting Chippewas, would you go for that? You know what they'd say? Hell yes.
Okay, but here's where I was getting with my long-winded explanation. Okay, because, you know, so I've read a bit about, like, the Native American experience in history, and particularly in northern New Mexico, where, you know, the Pueblo people live. And I discovered that historically the Navajos used to come down and, like, slaughter and steal and take the slaves from the Pueblo people. So the Navajos are actually kind of hated up in northern New Mexico. Even the Hopi and the Zuni, who are closer, they don't like the Navajos either. My point is that within the Indian, the Native American sort of history, it's been a constant civil war for centuries. And so I'm not so sure you could probably change it to the Washington Navajos. And I think you'd probably have a good bunch of people who up in northern New Mexico don't think that's such a great name. But the, you know, when you get into that sort of, you know, historic name calling and resentment building, it never ends. One, obviously, they go back far enough. And the Vikings, you know, goodness, they.
Well, no, I mean, that's what this guy said. He said, look, the Chippewas are pissed at us because we kicked everybody's ass in the northern plains, and we ran it until the white man came and kicked our ass.
Yeah, so that's what I'm getting.
Right.
Is the, you know, but, it is what it is. And, you know, I would have kept the name, but, you know, you pick your fights and I would trade a name change for a Super Bowl like any day of the week. So if that's what it takes to get to the Super Bowl, okay.
Got it.
Let's see.
All right, sir. What's the next thing you're going to write?
Oh, goodness. Some stuff about the Pacific Islands in Central Pacific.
Oh, that the Chinese are kind of reaching their tentacles on and making lucrative financial deals, knowing that these nations will default and then they'll take them over? Yay?
Got them. It's like that giant squid in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea that Captain Nemo sub. They've got their tentacles on it. There's still a chance to pry them loose, but that's what I'm on now.
Okay. All right, sir. First of all, we appreciate, as always, you staying up late, and always enjoy the subject matter and the discussion. So thank you, Grant.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Always enjoy it.
All right. There you have it. The one and only Grant Newsham here. Some interesting stuff. Yeah. You know, in fact, with all this other stuff going on the planet, it's been, I don't know, 3 weeks. I was up in Montana last week doing post-traumatic winning. And so so it's been a while since we caught up with Grant. So certainly a lot of stuff to talk to him about. And always an interesting guy to have on. All right, that'll do it. In the first hour, talking about the wisdom of Jack Riley. Jack Riley doing post-traumatic winning before post-traumatic winning was cool. You spell Riley, R-I-L-E-Y. Punch that in to the All Marine Radio podcast page. And hold on. Let me do that right now. And I'll tell you what you come up with. R-I-L-E-Y. Battlefield study. 3-9 was the reaction force that went to support 1-9 during Operation Buffalo. Sergeant Jack Riley. That was on March 31st of this year. So a little bit of what 3-9 did. Before that, Christmas inspiration to give to others. The wisdom of Marine veteran Sergeant Jack Riley, United States Marine Corps. That was last December. And then before that, in October, Jack Riley, squad leader, husband, father, reunion organizer, affected by Agent Orange and a post-traumatic winner. Before that, battlefield study, life after Vietnam, Agent Orange, post-traumatic winner, Jack Riley. And I'm going backwards, right? And so there you have it. In October of 2018 is when I met Jack, and that's when his battlefield study premiered. And so, but I will tell you, one of my favorite interviews I've ever done is Life After Vietnam, and where he talks about that. So I would tell you, in a little bit of your free time, don't be afraid to listen to that stuff. So, on a Tuesday, All Marine Radio, over, and quick tease for tomorrow. You're going to hear from some people who I met in Montana, who opened up their businesses to veterans, to Marine veterans, and were a huge part in the success of last week. So you're going to get to meet a guy by the name of Brock Boddicker. And Brock and his wife Jenny run the Kingfisher Lodge in Fort Smith, Montana, not Arkansas. So you'll get a chance to meet him. I'm hoping you get to meet Neil Clark, too. It was at his home in Helena, Montana. There's a big lake there, in case you don't know, that I was at over this past weekend. So you get a chance to hear them. And So I think you'll find it interesting. And then the Lynch Kenny Cosentini event on Thursday. And then on Friday, I think I'm going to see if I get my daughter-in-law to come back off and talk food now that she'd become a celebrity. So, yeah. So have a great day. Don't be afraid to unplug from social media. Don't be afraid to unplug from the news. And do positive things in your community. Touch people that you could touch in an inspirational and positive way. And do not sweat that stuff. It's the kabuki dance of whatever. Not worth it. Not worthy of your time. And certainly doesn't lead to your happiness. So, on a Tuesday, Allmarine Radio is over and out. We will be back. Mañana.